Welcome, everyone, to the Goalster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their fascinating and enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about crime fiction, hard-boiled, cozy, thriller, detective, and what makes a bestseller. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goalster.co.uk. And without further ado, I'm going to count to five and we begin. Hello and welcome, everyone, to Friday's Goalster Inside Story, where we tease, we laugh, we project curiosity and discover incredible things that we didn't know. My name is Humphrey Hawksley and I'm your host for the next hour, and it is my task to prize from my mild-mannered guest that you see sitting there, either beside me or underneath me, however your screen is, a panoply of fascinating things. Because, and I'm not sure if because is the right word, but my guest is in Kentucky, the USA, so it's early in the morning for him. Give him a bit of a break, but not too much. But he hails from Manchester on our British islands, where we'll find out why on earth he is in Kentucky. He is also, and I can guarantee this, a fine cook, a chef, I should say, so he knows his food. And I plan to ask him the difference between British and American culinary tastes. Those pancakes, syrups, massive steaks. Anybody got a view on that? Put that in the chat. And we're going to answer those questions. But none of that is why he is here, which is probably why we're going to be talking about it. He has written a superb first debut thriller. And as you can see, he's no spring chicken. So many of you could try your hands. There it is. It's called The Vicar. And no, it's not about a church. It is, though, in a way about religion or tribal stuff, because it's set in the Troubles of Northern Ireland, where my guest was an undercover agent, we'll say, shall we? Because this is a fiction book. And so what you're going to read, what you read there is based loosely on what he saw. And we meet his hero, Terry Nolan, and we will learn how as a child he was hooked on Sherlock Holmes and other great authors. What a feast, I should say. And as a cook, it's a good terminology. But welcome, AJ Chambers, to Goalster Inside Story.
Thanks, Humphrey. It's a pleasure to be here.
What time is it there, AJ?
Just 3 minutes after seven in the morning.
3 minutes after seven. Good. Well, thank you for getting up for us. Stay awake. But now I just have to tell everybody, AJ Chambers is not your real name. And we did have on, we had Ben Cave, What We Fear Most About Psychiatry, and his real name is Humphrey Needham Bennett. And we've had on CJ Carey, whose real name is Jane Thin. But with you, AJ Chambers, am I right? Your identity must remain a secret.
I'd like to keep it that way. Just, mainly because of the book subject matter, but also my past. And it's not something that you kind of want to shout from the windows as you, you know, at the neighbors kind of thing. So,
okay. So I can call you AJ, can I?
Sure can.
Thank you. So we'll call you AJ. And when you talk about AJ, so you don't still get up in the morning and check under the car for bombs and that sort of thing?
No.
Lucky, do you?
No, thank God, no. Maybe I should start. But
well, after this show, you might have to. Who knows?
Yeah, that's true. Because it's been over 30 years, actually 30 years. And so, you know, after being in the British military and being a chef, I went to university and got a literature degree and a history degree, and went right back to being a chef. And when the opportunity arose, I decided to start writing. So
okay, well let's go back to the beginning there, because we don't want to tell you a whole life story at once. But let's go back to the beginning. But in Northern Ireland, you were a soldier, or you were an intelligence agent, or what were you?
We're actually soldiers. We're part of a unit called the DET, which is 14 in. But we're soldiers.
Basically. Soldiers, okay. Yeah. But you were operating. That's a good word, isn't it? Undercover.
Plain clothes, basically. A lot of cue cards, and you know, looking for specific bad guys, and we would get information if there was going to be a hit on somebody or there was going to be an attack. Working with the Royals, the Constabulary, as well as the other units in the British military, we were trying to disrupt it, hopefully stop it. So.
And when you mentioned bad guys, are there bad guys on all sides?
Yeah. Yeah. Personally, a little bit about my background, my parents are Irish. For me, specifically for me, it wasn't so much going against the IRA or the INLA. For me, it was, we had the UBF on one side, the INLA, IRA on the other side. To me, they're all doing what we were trying to stop. Now, obviously, depending on the day, you could be working against one side or the other, really. And there are a lot of talk of, things that went on there, which I really am not going to get into much about. What was actually happening on the ground. But hence to say, we would use whatever tactics we could to disrupt operations of either side, really.
And what years were you there? This was at the height of what they call the Troubles.
Yeah, I was there in the, I'd say around the mid-80s. So... Oh.
Mid-80s. Okay, yeah. So it is a long time ago, but it was long before the Good Friday Agreement and the ceasefires and the peace.
Yeah. We spoke a little bit about this earlier, but the Good Friday Agreement, to me, is still miraculous that it even happened, and it's held pretty much. I mean, there's still obviously sectarian violence, but it still befuddles me how that even worked.
Why do you say that?
Well, you think about the two sides that were coming together. And it wasn't so much the British. But you had people like Ian Paisley and Mike McGuinness sitting down in a room together. I mean...
That's the head Protestant and the head Catholic in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. And, I mean, these guys were hardcore. I mean, I remember once... reading when I was much younger, that there was someone actually posed a question to the IRA, why didn't they kill Ian Paisley? And the IRA's response was, why would we kill him? He's the best recruiting tool we've got.
And when you say, I just said sort of flippantly in a way that the head Catholic and the head Protestant, that they're both passed away now.
But yeah.
Did they control the violent arms of that civil war?
Well, McGuinness was one of the, I'm trying to think the right word now, but they had commanders that were in certain areas of Northern Ireland. And before McGuinness went to Sinn Féin, he was, I can't remember now, it's a long time ago, but he was either the Londonderry Derry or the Belfast commander. So he was very much involved in what was going on, as was Gerry Adams. And then, of course, Ian Paisley was really about pieces,
But was he as militarily involved as Martin McGuinness?
I wish we could have proved it.
I'm going to stop there because it's an unfathomable thing, Northern Ireland, but let's go back to the book, because the book, show us that cover again. I want to see, because we had a week ago, we had Austin Camacho on, who's a Black American writer from Washington, D.C., and his book was called Subtle Felonies. This book is called The Vicar, but you have the man with his back to you, sort of running away or running towards something.
Yeah.
Did you have a say in that cover at all, AJ?
Surprisingly, which really still blows me away, is they sent us the Alex, the guy who designed the cover, sent us the original draft, and it was okayish. And we threw in some suggestions. And next thing, he came back with this. And I was like, wow. And then my agent, Doug, he suggested they put the where it is with the H and the I.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Excellent. Yeah. More of a cross.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of the religious terminal theme.
Yeah.
And they did it immediately. And they were fantastic. Blackstone Publishing were absolutely fantastic.
And were. Yeah,
I hear a lot of horror stories, you know, about some publishers, and Blackstone were wonderful.
It's a striking cover. And you begin the book in quite a terrifying scene, compelling. Just encapsulate that scene for us.
Oh, the one in the pub.
Yes, the one in the pub.
Well, the idea of, I mean, Terry's in MI5, and he is sent to apprehend or remove, should we say, a bomber who basically killed a bunch of people in a pub bombing in Bristol. And he's been undercover for 11 months in Belfast. And his job is to basically find the individual that did it. They know who it is, but he's gone to ground. So he basically is just sitting in a pub with friends, and he finds it, and he makes a phone call. You know, back in the day, they had the telephone boxes inside the pub and stuff. And a hit team is set out to get rid of the guy. And, you know, and that's basically Terry's mission, but he goes undercover under his own name, but is obviously scrubbed any mention of being in the military or anything.
And then he is the vicar, is he?
He is, yeah.
Why is he the vicar?
Because he has people that are his agents, which are parishioners. So he's like a vicar, one of them that basically runs a team of either agents or informers or whatever.
Right.
So hence the name.
Okay. And then just without giving too much away, there is a bigger threat. You set the scene at the beginning, but then the threats grow and grow. What are the stakes going through the book that Terry Nolan has to deal with?
So Terry finds out that there is a weapons of mass destruction heading to the UK from the USA, from a breakaway faction of, now they're called they call themselves the Real IRA or the New IRA. And this is a kind of breakaway faction of them. And Terry finds out that there are, like I said, weapons of mass destruction heading for Britain's biggest cities. And he's basically goes out to find out where, who, and how to stop it. So, and I've been telling myself, because what you find out early in the book is they suspect there's a mole.
In MI5?
Yeah, either in MI5 or in the British government. So he's basically done his own.
What is his own background?
You take what you know. I mean, I put down it, raised in Manchester.
Right.
Irish parents, grandfather in the IRA in 1916. Joins the military. Is in 14 in, and then is recruited to MI5 mainly because of his family's background.
And show us the book again, because on the opening page, you've got the emblem of MI5, haven't you?
Yeah, I didn't even know Blackstone were doing this, but it's actually pretty cool. It's supposed to look like a...
Put it right up to the camera if you can, so we can all see it. Yes. So that is the crown, top secret, and then a number of symbols in a circle there. Right. And that is the logo of MI5, is it?
Yeah, and actually, if you look... Let me just put this back. If you actually look at his feet, You see,
oh, yes.
It's the same logo.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes.
They got very, very rich, very good at designing and covering everything. So,
and you talked there about writing what you know, which is one of the great things in writing things. How do you balance what you know with what you shouldn't? Well, in your case, what you shouldn't tell, but also, excuse me, you don't want to write an autobiography as a fictional thing. You need to put in things that you don't know and situations that you don't know, although it's based in what you know. Give us an idea of how you constructed it and how many drafts and years it took to sort of throw things out and make things right.
Right. Well, that was one of the things I was very aware of not doing was, some of the names I used, some of the incidents, some of the people, especially in the Northern Ireland parts. I specifically changed names and bent stories a little bit from back in the day because you don't want to start throwing people's names out there. It's not something that you do. And I was very aware of staying away from certain subjects because you just don't want to compromise anything, even from back then. I'm a great believer in what was secret should stay secret in some respects, I mean, if you were doing bad things to people, then bye, go to jail as far as I'm concerned. But things that were secret, we signed the Official Secrets Act for a reason. And, I believe that 99.9% of the time, you don't need to start getting into, operations and things that happened back then. I was actually asked if I would write a book about what I did in the military, and I categorically refused. I said, no, it's not going to happen.
But this, it's also about how much you make up, isn't it? Ian Rankin, for example, who's been a Goldster Inside Story guest, he said that he didn't have to go and research the inside of a police station because it was just a big office with desks and computers. So you can make that up. Did you find yourself, when you were talking about where people would, I don't want to give too much away, where they met, where they were questioned and all that sort of thing. Did you make that up or were they places that you remembered?
Some of it was places I remembered. I mean, everywhere in the book is somewhere I've been. I know the area. I know, certain areas. And I've changed, obviously, like where a house is or where a building is, things like that. But pretty much everywhere in the book I've been to. When I say write what you know, obviously you got a license to, invent, fictionalize. I mean, because you're a writer. I mean, you've got to be able to do that, Otherwise, can you imagine talking about writing about an interrogation and
go on forever?
That goes on for a month. I mean, it'd be so boring. You'd be like falling asleep. It'd just be the whole book. You speed things up and you make things more exciting or more violent than they actually would be.
Do you fight against that or does it come naturally? I mean, you told us the sort of stakes is that these weapons of mass destruction are heading for Britain, which, touch wood, we hope isn't happening at the moment. So when you were going through it, where did you think this is too far-fetched, it's not credible, or we do it here, we do it here, we do it here? Did you have to...
I did kind of want to keep it to the point that you could... It could happen, in if you know what I mean. I didn't want to... I mean, Terry doesn't run up walls. He doesn't do triple backflips. He's not like bulletproof, like certain characters I could mention. And he gets hurt. He gets beaten up. He just keeps going. He's like the Energizer button. I mean,
Duracell keeps clapping.
Yeah, he won't give up. I mean, that's his thing. He's dedicated to what he's doing. But I tried to keep it in the realms of possibility and not so mythical that you'd be sitting there going, there's no way, you know? So, like, you try and keep sort of operational how things happen, like to some sort of realism.
And where do you think your readers, when you're trying to work out the stakes, and you've got the stakes now, the weapons going into Britain, do they care about Terry getting beaten up and how he handles that more or less than the actual stakes of Britain getting destroyed by weapons of mass destruction?
I think, you know, it's hard to put, but there's one part in the book where someone says to Terry, you're not a good guy, are you? And he says, no. And he isn't. I mean, he is a good person, don't get me wrong, in a lot of respects. And he has kind of a moral thing. He's not like James Bond. He doesn't bounce in and out of bed with, you know, everybody in sight or whatever.
Is that more or less immoral than killing somebody?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he will kill somebody just at the blink of an eye, but he won't kill a civilian.
He won't kill a civilian. And he'll
innocence.
He'll jump in and out of bed with somebody who he loves, but not just for a one-night stand.
Yeah, that's not him. I mean, he is, you know, he still wears a wedding ring, but I'm not going to get into that more, but he does actually still wear his wedding ring. Yeah. And so, he's got quite a high moral compass in that respect. But when it comes to the job, all bets are off. You'll do whatever it takes to stop what's happening. So
I'd like now to go back to you a bit, and I want to come back to Terry, but I want to go back to you've done this work that we've got a rough idea of now in Northern Ireland. And if anybody, as I say, has got any thoughts, questions on this, just put it in the chat, and we'll talk to AJ about it. But you left the military, you left that job.
Sorry.
And you ended up, or you went to Kentucky. How did that happen?
It's a very circular route. I actually lived in Italy and then obviously became a chef, went to university, all that fun stuff. And then I've lived in Chicago, in Michigan, in South Florida, Connecticut, and now Kentucky. My wife's actual job brought us to Kentucky.
So all that Chicago and Connecticut, is that through love, through your domestic arrangement, or was that because that's where the restaurant
was? I was actually, yeah, Chicago, that was where I was living when I met my wife.
Okay.
And Florida was, I was flying in and out of Florida working, and my wife decided to get a job there. So we basically just moved all that way down to South Florida, which is lovely for a while. And let me tell you, South Florida is very nice for a while, but after a bit, you get really sick of seeing palm trees every day. I mean,
being what every day?
You know, seeing palm trees and, you know, like walking outside and it's 95% humidity. The summers are just lovely. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's people come in February and they go, you're so lucky to live here. You're like, come back in August.
Yeah. And also you occasionally one wants to get out with a bit of fog and rain and frost.
That's right. Yeah. Seasons, you know. Yeah, I remember when we moved to Connecticut, which was from my wife's work, it was snowing. And we drove into Connecticut with the kids and the pets and everything. And, you know, we had the moving truck bringing everything. And it was snowing, and it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful to see snow again. It was just
So what made you go from being an undercover agent in the wars of Northern Ireland to becoming a chef?
my dad always loved to cook. And my father had spent about 15 years, there's a cat about to appear, if you excuse me.
Hello, cat.
Sure.
Yeah, listen, you can see the tail.
Yeah, that's Amelia. Yeah. My father had spent about 15 years in India during and after World War II.
Right.
And so growing up, we didn't have much money. My father was disabled out of the military. And so, you know, council house, that sort of thing. But he could cook, and he could cook really good Indian food. So as a treat, you know, every couple of weeks, he would make a big batch of Indian food. And I fell in love with flavor. It was just something that I really loved. So I got to experience, you know, we didn't go out to restaurants and stuff. So that's how I got to experience the joy of cooking, basically. It was watching my mom and dad cook. And it was something I'd always liked to do. It was kind of like the thing to ground oneself, shall we say.
So when you were lying in dark cubby holes in Northern Ireland, waiting to track the bad guy, were you running recipes through your head for when you would get back from the army?
But this is going to sound crazy, but when I was a chef, some of my best recipes I would come up with driving the car.
Okay.
I'd just start working on a recipe in my head. Instead of listening to the radio or something. And then turn up at the restaurant and, you know, get out the pans and start making it, you know?
So to give us the best or the most fulfilling restaurant that you worked in, where was it? What did it look like? What was your job in it?
There was a restaurant in Chicago called Heaven on Seven, and then there was one down in South Florida that I worked in. Which was getting close to when I actually left the business. But the thing I love more than anything was just developing food, developing recipes, coming up with something different, something new. And that ability, that license to play and work on things. And when you work as an executive chef, that's what it's all about. It used to be anyway. Now you have like menu designers and people like that coming in.
Give us the ingredients of the best dish that you ever constructed.
I'll have to email it to you.
We have an audience here. They want to hear it.
There's actually a dressing that I used to make. And it's a passion fruit vinaigrette. And it is obviously passion fruit, mango, mustard, and then Chinese rice wine vinegar, and olive oil, extra virgin, and a few other bits, salt, pepper, a few other bits and bobs. But it tastes like the best Italian dressing you ever had in your life. And it is just very rich and just unctuous. And it is lovely on any sort of seafood or chicken.
And say you're doing with chicken, what would the chicken have?
Well, I mean, you know, like, because I specialized in Creole and Caribbean. So,
okay.
I mean, when you look at Creole, obviously, that's much more defined as to what the dishes are, you know, etouffee, all the dishes, such. I mean, there's rules in place for a reason. But when you do Caribbean or Caribbean fusion, they actually down in Florida, they call it Floribbean. And you get to play. So you get to invent, you know, and you start to mess around with things. You take some traditional recipes like the ropa vieja, which is a Cuban dish. That would be Anchin's old clothes, shredded beef that you've basically cooked for hours with peppers, and you shred it down so it's in pieces, and you serve it with rice and plantains and stuff. And for me, I always like to spice it up a lot more. make it more of a hit when you're eating it. So, but just things like that. I mean, you would take some chicken. You could either grill it off or roast it off in the oven, and then, you know, dress it or whatever in anything you want. I mean, it's all playful as long as it works. That's the thing.
I was going to say, have you ever invented a dish that you thought would be absolutely fantastic and nobody's liked it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've all been there. I think every chef has been there where they're working on stuff, and you make it, you taste it, and then you sort of, there's the bin, you know? And you can say, okay, I tried it. Like, no. Bloody awful. And then you go back again and you figure out why, what didn't work, what did you do wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And you keep at it. I mean, you just keep working and working and working. And sometimes it can be the second, third, fourth, 20th try at a dish and finally it comes together. And you know, that's just the way it is. It's like writing. It's the same thing. You got to stick at it.
Yes, I'm going to talk about structured writing based on that, but I'm still curious about... Now, whenever I go into a restaurant that's basically not a McDonald's, there's always a word on the menu of something I don't understand, and the people I'm with don't, and you have to ask the waiter what this thing is. Is that something that you guys concoct to confuse us?
Sometimes I think so. Sometimes I think...
You know what I mean, don't you?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, hell, it's happened to me. I've sat in a restaurant with what, you know? And sometimes it's them just trying to be more, thinking that they're being more elegant, you know? Oh, this sounds so much better, you know, than...
Do they just make the words up, AJ, or do they actually mean carrot?
They may take something that, you know, you think of in one way, and then they'll, to make it sound fancier, they'll call it, like, it's make it sound, you know, more French or whatever.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you don't find that so much here. But it always amazes me when you watch shows like MasterChef or whatever, and the way they're describing food, you're like, come on.
Yes.
You know, it's like, give me a break.
We had one of your, you mentioned MasterChef. We had the MasterChef champion of 2017 onto One Side Story, Salima Ahed, who's a gastroenterologist, which gets me onto my next question to you. So she knows exactly what you take in, and she cooks and does recipes and how that works and everything like that. But the difference between the British diet and the American diet...
I remember when I first moved here and I was living in the Midwest, and I said, what is wrong with, how can you intake that much cheese? Like, how can anybody eat that much cheese? It absolutely just blew me away. I mean, they would put cheese on everything, and I don't mean a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's gotten better over the years, but it's still there. I mean, my God, you go to Wisconsin or somewhere and it's like, you know, let's bathe you in cheese and you can lick it off yourself. I mean, it's it's very good. Don't get me wrong. Cheese is delicious, but, you know, if you have a cheese allergy or dairy allergy, you're done for.
The obesity in the US, particularly in places like, as you said, you know, Nebraska or somewhere like that, is quite serious, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, if you go to the north of England, it's the same. I think a lot of it has to do with access to healthy food. You know, you go in some of the poorer areas and they call them food deserts. They don't even have grocery stores. So, you know, you want to go buy vegetables, eat fresh vegetables, and there aren't any. I mean,
And you have to get processed vegetables.
Yeah, so you have to get processed food, fast food, which is cheap. And that's what they have access to. I mean, I remember growing up in the north of England. I mean, we had grocery stores and stuff, but the idea of, you know, fish and chips and fried stuff. I'm not saying this is true of everybody, but it was cheap.
Yeah.
And if you don't have much money, if you're working class poor, and the same here, you find that the poverty levels are driving a lot of obesity. It's not because people don't want to cook. It's they don't have the money. You know, they're on the subsistence level living. And they eat what their parents ate, what their grandparents ate, which is usually unhealthy, you know.
How easily fixable is it?
Well, access to good, nutritious food, like grocery store, a real grocery store, would help. Instead of having to go and eat what you can find at a gas station or a convenience store. And there shouldn't be food deserts. There shouldn't be areas of this country, even though they're run down, they're poor, where you can't at least walk or take a bus, you know, a short distance to a grocery store. Let's face it, if you want to go to the grocery store and you don't have a car, and you know America, if you don't have a car, you're basically screwed. Who is going to do a two-hour bus ride to go to a grocery store? Then take the bus 2 hours back just to go buy vegetables. You're not going to do it. You've got family, you've got job, you're exhausted. It's not going to happen. So, yeah, I think one of the main things will be access to fresh food. And in this day and age now, I mean, you see it in the UK, but people using food banks.
Oh, God, yes. So I volunteered at a food bank. It's quite horrendous what you
said. Right, it is. And it's sad.
These are people who are working,
right,
who are using food banks, but also the food that we were handing out was exactly what you said. It was all processed stuff, tinned stuff. There was nothing fresh.
You know, one of the things I know about, I actually developed some food products back in the day. And if you go to a grocery store, you know the middle part of the grocery store where they have all the shelves?
Yeah.
You know, different aisles with all the cans. They call that mainline grocery. And then around the edges, you have the periphery, you have like the meat, the fish, the vegetables. They have all different sections, you know, deli or whatever. But mainline groceries where most of the garbage is.
Yes.
Every now and again, you find, you know, like organic food there, which obviously is usually a lot more expensive. Or you find all natural. Natural doesn't mean anything. You see natural on a label, it doesn't mean a damn thing. I get quite heated about this, but when you see natural on a label, that term should be banned because it doesn't actually mean anything, especially over here. So but if it says all natural or organic, that means there's no preservatives and everything else in there.
Natural or organic means... So the other issue over here in Britain that we've had is this, and we're getting them all the time, warnings against processed foods or ultra-processed foods. But I was in my local supermarket the other day. You don't know what is in processed. So if you wanted to get some cheese or meat, any type of meat that you get is in a packet, I presume, is processed.
Yeah. They add nitrogen. They blow in nitrogen in some meat products to make it stay fresher longer or make it pinker looking when it starts getting to its final, you know, throwaway day.
Saliha told us when she was doing this show, she suggested to try different types of food, and particularly the Asian supermarkets, that you can go in there and buy it and then go back and cook it. And if you got into a routine, it was going to be cheaper and not take you any more time than it would heating up a TV meal.
Right, right. I mean, the big joke when Food Network was on, I actually have a friend of mine who used to be a food editor of the Tampa Tribune, and we actually were having a chuckle about this, but it is quite sad. People would come home and they would heat up a TV dinner and sit down and watch Food Network. And the common terminology for the Food Network was food porn, because that's what it is, right? And he'd say, people would then say, I don't have time to cook.
Yes.
They would heat up, you know, whatever.
And then say they don't have time to cook, and then they'd go and watch food porn or whatever.
What it is, food porn. Yeah. I think a lot of it, you remember in the old days when you went to school and they had home economics at school and you got to learn to cook a few things and nothing spectacular. You know, but you learn a little thing, then you go home and cook it for your parents. Rock cakes, I remember making at school, which was actually quite good. But that's gone now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, if you even have sports in school now or music, there's no way they're going to have home economics for the most part. So that learning there that you had as a kid, even though it wasn't great, but you still learn how to cook something. You could actually make a meal.
You knew how to scramble some eggs or to cook a steak or something like that. I do remember actually on a filming trip for the BBC some years back, we were in Nebraska for about 3 or 4 days. And I guarantee, I know that when we moved from Nebraska to Colorado, which is a slightly different mindset in Colorado, one, the people were all jogging and looked a lot thinner and fitter. And secondly, I swear I was suffering from malnutrition when I got out because I just hadn't had any vegetables. There were no vegetables there. There was no fruit there. And I ordered a lasagna at what was meant to be the best Italian restaurant in one of the towns we were at. And it was just a couple of things of pasta with some ketchup in the middle.
Yeah.
And that was,
I remember once I was meeting with a buyer at a very large grocery chain. I developed some products that we were putting in the store. And we started talking about the difference between sugar and corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
And I basically said, well, sugar, I'm going to put it in an American way that you can understand this. What it does to you. I said, sugar is like a gun. Someone's shooting a bullet at you. Corn syrup is like someone throwing a grenade at you, right? The damage it does. And high fructose corn syrup is like someone dropping a 1 kiloton nuclear weapon on you because it's going to kill you. And he goes, what? And I was like, it's in everything. They're putting it in ketchup for kids. You want to know why you've got obesity? It's because they're putting sugar with meat. I mean, it's in everything. So he goes, come with me. We went down to his section that he was buying for. And he goes, grab a cart. So we got a couple of grocery carts. And he just started throwing everything off the shelves that had high fructose corn syrup in it. And he goes, I'm not carrying it anymore. Because no one had ever explained how dangerous it is. Now, I'm sure that I most would get sued now by the high fructose corn syrup makers, but it's very bad for you. I mean, if you think about it, it's terrible for you. And they put it in everything. I mean, everything. Because it would issue like the tooth, you know. People like sugar. You eat more.
Is it the same in the UK?
As far as I know, your rules are different. Like, you can't even have American cereal in the UK. But from what I understand it, a lot of cereals and banned. They're not allowed to sell them as they're constructed here. You can't buy them in England or Great Britain.
Because our food then is generally healthier than...
I hate to say this, but I think that's partly because of the EU. And I know that's not like the buzzword these days is talking about the EU.
It's a lot of stuff we can't talk about, but you can say it on Gold's Foot, yes.
The rules of the EU made people healthier. I mean, you know, because a lot of those rules you had to follow. So you were eating healthier food. There was a lot of things that were added to food that no longer could be added. A lot of chemicals that were added to food, a lot of colorants that were added to food to make things, you know, shiny and pretty that were no longer allowed to be added because people actually didn't make common sense rules because they didn't want you eating garbage. My daughter has an illness. It's called gastroparesis. And it basically means frozen stomach. And what takes us 30 minutes to digest takes her about 8 hours. So anything with chemicals destroys her.
she's getting sick, she's throwing up, you know. And she's been to Europe about 3 times with my wife when my wife goes out of business. And you know, she can eat anything.
Right.
Still never a problem.
Yeah.
Never gets sick.
In Europe.
Yeah.
Where she lives with you in the States?
Yes. Yes. We have to buy everything organic. So this is a big deal for me, like food, like healthy food.
I can see this. Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned we are not a political show. I'm going to stress this here, and you stress that there. But let's go back a little bit to the vicar, Terry and Northern Ireland, but also to yourself, because you did that work there. And then there was the Brexit thing, and you saw all that stuff that we all saw about the Northern Ireland agreement that most of us didn't really understand. What were your thoughts when that happened?
Oh, I was scared, first of all. I mean, I felt for the people, you know. That was my biggest concern. That's why I started writing The Vicar. The idea of The Vicar is it's kind of a what if, you know. You remember, I finished writing The Vicar right before a pandemic, so. And it's a what if, because of Brexit. What if they start, you know, you do get a breakaway faction. What if they try and impose borders? What if, you know, you try and disrupt the flow of goods going from south to north, north to south? And that includes, obviously, bad things as well, with the open borders.
So it was a kind of message.
I don't want to say it's a message. I just was kind of, I remember as a kid, I watched this movie called If. Do you ever remember?
Oh, yes, I do. Where they very huge up at school, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. And the Christian brother beating the child, the kid,
yes,
you know, mercilessly. And for me, that was the vicar. The idea of the vicar is if. What if? So, listen, they've had relative stability in the north of Ireland, like I said, and it was at the time for me anyway, Northern Ireland agreement, I thought it was a joke when it first happened.
You thought it wouldn't work.
Ah, he's got to last a week, you know? And it didn't. And I'm sure the people of Northern Ireland were a great driving force behind it working. But also people like Martin McGuinness, who went down and basically tried to get rid of all the weapons, all the weapons caches that there were and stuff like that. And it was their iron control, because you didn't mess with these guys. You didn't mess with Ian Paisley. You didn't mess with Martin McGuinness. Yeah. These guys were MU, you know. And so the fact that it held was astonishing to me. And then Brexit starts. And that was my first thought. What are they thinking? Because that's the whole premise of the Northern Ireland Agreement, is the open border. Is being part of the EU.
Yes.
I was like, they're mad. Do they know what could happen?
Yeah.
I mean, do they want to go back to the 80s, to all the bombing and everything else? Do they want this? Because if this goes wrong, this is where we're heading. Yeah. And it still to this day worries me. It worries me. The people in Northern Ireland deserve to live in relative peace.
I can see that you're showing your passion about food and passion about this in a very convincing way, AJ. You got to the stage where you're a chef. You had this book in your mind and you wanted to be a writer. What was the catalyst that said, right, I'm going to stop being a chef, I'm going to sit down and write?
So I actually messed my back up when I was in the military, and I finally was going to have a surgery done on my spine. And I went to my doctor to get my pre-surgery clearance, you know, and they do the EKG and they do all that other fun stuff. And the doc wasn't there. So I did my EKG and I got in the car and started driving home. And my cell phone rang and it was my doctor. And that was the first moment I knew I was screwed. And she said to me, I've made an appointment for you to see a cardiologist in the morning. And that's when I knew I was done. I was toast. I mean, I thought.
How long ago was that?
This was 8 years ago. And so I saw the cardiologist, went through all the tests, and he told me that I couldn't be a chef anymore, that I was going to die. And he put in a defibrillator pacemaker.
Why couldn't you be a chef?
Yeah, I couldn't be a chef anymore. So I stopped being a chef immediately. And I was sitting around one day, my wife was getting ready for work, and she sort of looked at me like the wife does sometimes. And she said to me, what are you going to do? You've got to do something, you know. And I looked and I said, so I'm going to write a novel. And she looked at me and went, you what? I said, I'm going to write a book. And she went, sure you are. And that was all I needed. So The Vicar is actually the third novel I've written. It's the first one published. And so I wrote a book, and I was fortunate enough to find a fantastic editor, because you have to get your own editor these days. His name is Pat LaBrute. Oh, he's been in the business over 40 years. He's a fantastic guy. And Pat introduced me to my agent, Doug Grant, who you've met. And that's how I ended up with an agent and an editor.
I mean, that's a very interesting thing. But we have on Goldster, we have creative writing courses, and a number of people that are writing it or thinking of getting published, like you, because you're no spring chicken, are you, AJ?
No.
Say that you look great, but
I've actually lost weight. So
I lost weight for our show, did you? But just go through that again, that process that you did, and the process now, because you're on a show telling us about your fantastic book, but how hard is it? How committed do you have to be to get to where you are now?
100%. I hear you when people say 110%, because that's what you're saying. You have to be 100%. You have to be all in. I don't mean you have to quit your job and go live in the woods and, you know, live in a cabin or something, but you have to be 100% all in. And obviously there has to be something there, some sort of talent. I tell people, listen, I was a literature major in college, you know, all that fun stuff. I have learned more from my editor in the time I've been working with him than I ever did in college. Because what an editor teaches you and your agent and people, you know, in that caliber is they teach you about pace, and they teach you about how to write a book. Because writing a book is not like writing a term paper. And sitting down and writing 85, 90,000 words is a lot different. But the biggest thing is you have to be all in. It has to be, it can't be a half-assed thing like, oh, I think I'm going to write a book, and then every few months sit down and write 2 pages. You have to be there, and you have to put the sweat and the toil and the late nights and the lack of sleep, and it all adds up. And then when your editor comes back and says, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, you need to improve this, you need to improve this. Don't sit there and cry and go, woo-woo. Do it, because that's their job. So the biggest advice I can give everybody, anyone who wants to do this, is you have to be all in and find a damn good editor. And I mean a good editor. I don't mean someone who spell checks you. I mean an editor that has been in the business a long time.
And that's very interesting. How much of the original, your first draft of The Vicar that you gave to that editor, to what we see now on the book, how different is it?
It's not very different at all, actually, because this is the third book I've written. This was the third book I've written.
So did the editor look at all three books, or?
Yeah, he's my editor. So he you learn as you go. So you get better and better and better. It's like an athlete. An athlete doesn't pick up a pole vault and suddenly just jumps over a bar 20 feet in the air. You know, they practice. They practice for years. And writing's the same. You've got to, Poirot used to say, you've got to work the little gray cells, right? You have to work your mind. You have to work it, because you're going to get better and better and better. It always astonishes me when people write a book, the first book they've ever written, and they're whining because they've had 20 rejections. I'm like, 20, is that all? Welcome to...
How many have you had?
Hundreds. And you've had hundreds of rejections, and some of them are very, very, very hard.
Yeah.
I mean, hard.
There's a couple of questions coming. Actually, just sit where you are. I've got to tell people what's coming up. Then we'll deal with the questions, and we are almost out of time here, but we will make it work. So coming up, we have next Tuesday, October the 10th, Lucinda is with menopause supremo Cheryl McDonald and her latest book, Yoga Pause, What Women Need to Know After 40 and Why Yoga is the Answer. October is World Menopause Month, apparently. October 12th, Jim Kelly will be chatting to Lucinda on the few days after the publication of his latest book, The White Lie, which is based on Captain Scott's last expedition. And then the next day, October 13th, Lucinda with Ruth Lee, A Great Deal of Ingenuity, a collection of Pride and Prejudice stories. That's for Jane Austen fans. October 19th, Lucinda is with Adrian Magson, crime and thriller writer extraordinaire. Death at the Old Asylum and Killing Waters are two of his latest. And then October 20th, I am with thriller writer Kenneth DeClaver, who's also a psychiatrist in Dallas, Texas, and for many years headed the U.S. State Department's mental health program. His latest book is The Last Violinist. Also, excuse me, I've got a bug. Please keep a track. We have the great Bonnie Greer at the Riverstone Kensington on November the 16th. And we're spreading our wings on December the 7th for a show with Bonnie and the great African artist Lanre Oligarke from Lanre's studio in Regent Street. We are looking for 3 volunteers to be there and to join us in an art class with Lanre's students. If you want to come, let Joe Carter-Hawkins or the concierge at golster.co.uk come and put it in. We have some messages coming in. Let's have a look at these. With Celia, documentary about processed food. A lot of chemicals were used to extend the shelf life, but they were just sweeteners to make it more palatable. And our palates are now so used to sugar and high salt content. Celia wants to know, what time of day do you write?
Mainly at night. I will start writing sometimes at 9:30, 10, and I will finish around 5 o'clock in the morning.
Right through the night. Geeta, one of her friends has dyslexia and wants to write a book. Do you have any extra advice? She's a great storyteller, but having suffered burns, missed out on 3 to 5 years of schooling. Any advice?
Find an editor that understands how to help them, you know, how to help and to basically change things that they need to change. And if there's an editor out there that has ever worked with someone with dyslexia, that'd be ideal, because they would help no end.
So your general tip is on the writing bit is to write a bit what you know, which you've done, stay with it 100%, and find a good editor, and don't whine.
Yeah, because a good editor is going to make you look good. But don't get me wrong, they're not going to write it for you. They're not going to take what you've written and then change things. They're going to hint and suggest, develop this character, do this. Sometimes I'll say, get rid of this because it's slowing down the entire chapter. You know, depending obviously on what you're writing. I write thrillers, I write crime thrillers, I write spy thrillers. So there has to be a certain pace that you maintain to keep the reader interested.
And are the other two coming out? Are they part of this series?
Well, we just submitted the sequel to The Vicar, to Blackstone. So fingers crossed that gets picked up. And I've also written 2 further crime thrillers. That one of them is called Dr. Cupid. It's about a cop in DC who was an NFL linebacker and is now like the lead detective with Metro DC RSI. And the other one I've written about him, his name is Xavier Black, BLADQUE. And the second book is called Blackwood. So I'm hoping they'll eventually get picked up. So it's a long process. It takes two years to get
booked. And I want a 3-word tip from you, and we touched on it. You get to a certain age, certain stage of life, changes in life, you're facing challenges. What is your advice to keep going?
Say again? Too old.
Never too old.
Never too old.
See, go for it.
Go for it. Go for it and never too old. That's it. And Time's Winged Chariot is attacking us and we cannot fend it off. We've had a lot of fun today, haven't we? We've done food and Northern Ireland and good knows what. And I've learned a lot. Until next week with Lucinda and Cheryl McDonald and Yoga Pause. Stay curious, stay involved, stay social, stay safe. Try some great Kentucky food or Florida food or anything. Unprocessed.
Bourbon. Try some bourbon.
Oh, try some bourbon, of course. Yeah. And, of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, AJ Chambers, for a great, fun Goldster conversation. Bye, AJ. We'll see you soon.
Yeah. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.